Welcome to History Counts. History provides the roadmap to the future. If you want to know where you're going, you have to understand where you've been. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. The Federal Reserve System may be more important than Congress or the President in the economic life of Americans. Who created it and why? Please stay tuned for this edition of History Counts, The Creature from Jekyll Island. Welcome back to History Counts. This is Ken McDermott Rowe. Today we're going to talk about the origin of a very important but not well understood institution, the Federal Reserve. We're very fortunate to have as our guest G. Edward Griffin, author of The Creature from Jekyll Island, a second look at the Federal Reserve. The Creature from Jekyll Island is a classic study of the origins and operations of the Federal Reserve, as well as a history of the money system. Originally published in 1994, The Creature from Jekyll Island is now in its 20th printing. Mr. Griffin is the president of Freedom Force International, a network of men and women from 52 countries who seek to shape public policy in their respective countries in favor of personal freedom and global freedom. His website is freedomforceinternational.org. Mr. Griffin, thanks very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Ken. It's a pleasure to be here.
Mr. Griffin, could you tell us, why is the Federal Reserve important?
Well, the Federal Reserve System is important for a couple of reasons, Ken. First of all, it is the engine that creates the money supply for the United States. Many people think that the money is created by the Treasury, created by the government, and that's not true. The group that controls the creation and extinguishing of the money supply is the Federal Reserve System, and the Federal Reserve is not a government agency. It is a cartel. It's a cartel of private banks, which are in working in cooperation with the government, which have been chartered by the government to do whatever it is they want to do. But so the entity that creates and determines the supply of the money is very important because the supply of money affects the economic well-being of every one of us. The amount of money in circulation, if it perfectly paces the supply of goods and services, then we have a very stable purchasing monetary unit. What $1 buys today, it will buy 10 years from now. It'll be very stable. But if the money supply expands at a rate greater than goods and services in the economy, then the value of the individual dollar goes down. And we have that phenomenon called inflation, which means that what we buy today for a dollar, next year might take a dollar and a half, and the following year $2.50, and so forth. And inflation is very important to the citizens of this country because it is a hidden tax. It is a means by which our savings and our purchasing power is extracted from us in a mechanism that is very little understood by the average person. They think that inflation is somehow just a natural phenomenon. It's like rain or a cloudy day. It just happens. Well, it's not true. So inflation is important because money is important to us. Every transaction we make, everything we want to buy, everything we want to do, almost everything anyway, is expressed in terms of money. So if a organization has the ability to determine the value of that medium of exchange that we call money, then they have the ability to determine our economic well-being. And so that's a pretty important reason right there. They determine how well we live. And we have no voice in that whatsoever. I mentioned the economic reason that the Federal Reserve is important, but there's a political reason too, and that is that the entity that controls the money supply and is able to create money out of nothing, which the Federal Reserve can do, and loan it or appear to loan it to the government, that's a very politically powerful group of people, and it turns out over a period of time, the banks that do that, that create this money and loan it to the government to cover their deficit, they eventually wind up owning the government. So the Federal Reserve is important for an economic reason and a political reason, and both of those impact our personal lives very intimately.
Well, now, please take us back to November 1910 and tell us the story of the secret meeting at Jekyll Island, Georgia, at which the Federal Reserve was conceived.
The reason I called my book The Creature from Jekyll Island is not just because the title is enticing, although that's part of it, but because Jekyll Island is a real island. It's not just because I didn't just make up the word to make it sound like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, or make it sound like the creature from the Black Lagoon or something like that. Jekyll Island is a real island. It's off the coast of Georgia, and it was on that island back in 1910 that the Federal Reserve System was created. And early on in my research, when I discovered that, I thought that was very curious. Why wouldn't the Federal Reserve be created in Washington, D.C.? Why on an island? It turns out that this island was privately owned in those days. It was called the Jekyll Island Club, and it was a private resort. It was owned by a small group of billionaires from New York, people like J.P. Morgan and William Rockefeller, and their business associates and their families. That's where their families went to spend the cold winter months in New York. They had to get out of there and went down to Georgia. And on this island, there was a beautiful clubhouse. It's still there, by the way. You can visit it today. That was the center of their social activities, and it was in that clubhouse back in 1910 that seven men gathered there and created the Federal Reserve System. And when I got into this, I discovered that the circumstances surrounding this meeting were very curious also, because these men practiced a great deal of secrecy. They did not want anyone to know that they were going. And as a matter of fact, they denied that they were going. They denied that they went. For several years afterwards, they denied that any such meeting took place. It was November of 1910 when seven men gathered at the New Jersey Railroad Station. And it was there that they were instructed to come together very secretly. They were not to be seen together. They were to come separately. They were not to dine together. They were to avoid newspaper reporters at all costs. And they were instructed to gather and board the private railroad car of Senator Nelson Aldrich, who at that time was a very powerful political figure. And now, he had a private railroad car, and in those days, that would be like having your own private, possibly Learjet, but more like a Boeing 747. And so they assembled on his private railroad car, and they traveled for a day and a night, two nights, I should say, and a day, down to Brunswick, Georgia. And on this trip, they were instructed, when they addressed each other, to use their first names only, not to use last names. And two of the men even abandoned their last names, and their first names both, and used code names. And I thought that was curious when I read about that. And then I found out later in the memoirs of one of the men who was on that train, he said that the reason they did that is because they were worried that the servants on board the train might find out who they all were. Now, of course, the servants knew who Senator Aldrich was. They worked for him. They might have known the identities of one or possibly two of the others, but not all of the others. And they were afraid that if the servants talked about all of these important people who were on that train and went to Jekyll Island, that the word would get out and the secrecy would be exposed. And so that's the kind of thing secrecy that they went through. Even when they got to the clubhouse, all of the normal servants that worked there had been dismissed for the week, and they'd been replaced by temporary servants, and the reason was exactly the same.
Now, you say Senator Aldrich represented both the interests of J.P. Morgan and was at the same time was tied to the Rockefellers as the father-in-law of John D. Rockefeller, Jr.
Yes, exactly.
And now those two firms were very well represented, the Rockefeller interests and the Morgan interests.
They were the dominant American firms that were represented, yes. In a moment, I'll read the list of the names, and there were seven of them.
Yes, please.
And you'll see that they represented all the big American banks and the international financial interests from Europe as well. They went to Jekyll Island, and for the next week, they sat around a table, and they hammered out all the details of the Federal Reserve, and then they came back and disappeared into the environs of New York. Now, the question is, why did they, engage in such secrecy? And the answer is stunning when you go back and look at the period of history in which this happened. The Federal Reserve System was sold to the American people as a solution to an economic problem that existed then. There were a lot of bank failures. People were losing their money in the banks. Also, people were concerned about the great concentration of economic power in the hands of a few Wall Street firms. And they wanted a law through Congress that was going to break the grip of the money trust. That's the phrase that they used in those days. You can find it in all kinds of editorial sniffs on the newspaper. They're going to break the grip of the money trust. Well, it turns out that the men who went to this meeting and created the Federal Reserve System to break the grip of the money trust were the money trust. These were the men, the very people, the very institutions, the Wall Street firms and banking institutions, insurance companies, and brokerage houses. These were the epitome of the very thing which the Federal Reserve System was supposed to control. And so what we find here is a brilliant strategy. These men knew that there was public clamor for some kind of regulation of the banking industry, and they decided not to just sit back and wait for that to happen, that they would take the lead, and they would propose the regulation of the banking industry according to their specifications, to their benefit, and not to the benefit of the American people.
Tell us about the men who were on that trip.
That's very revealing. Of course, we know that Senator Aldrich was there. He was the one with the railroad car. He was the Republican whip in the Senate at that time. He was chairman of the National Monetary Commission, which was the particular group in the government that was to propose the Federal Reserve Act. That was his job as the chairman. He was a business associate of J.P. Morgan, his father-in-law to John D. Rockefeller, Jr., as you mentioned a moment ago. Then there was Abraham Piat Andrew. He was Assistant Secretary of the Treasury at that time. That doesn't really describe him very well because he was far more than just a bureaucrat. He actually came from a banking family. He was very powerful in banking circles, which is why he was Assistant Secretary of the Treasury. Frank Vanderlip was there. He was president of the National City Bank of New York. That was the most powerful of all the banks at that time. And he represented the financial interests of William Rockefeller and the international investment banking house of Kuhn, Loeb & Company. Henry Davison was there. He was the senior partner of the J.P. Morgan Company. Charles D. Norton was there also. He was president of J.P. Morgan's First National Bank of New York, another one of the giants. Present was Benjamin Strong, head of J.P. Morgan's Bankers Trust Company. And finally, Paul Warburg, who many people believe was the most influential of them all. He was a full partner in Kuhn, Loeb & Company, a naturalized American citizen born in Germany. And his firm, and he personally, represented the Rothschild banking dynasty in England and France. And all this time, he remained kept a very close business liaison with his brother, Max Warburg, who was head of the Warburg Banking Consortium in Germany and the Netherlands.
So the Rothschilds and the Warburgs were the giants in the financial industry in Europe?
In Europe, you bet they were. And so there you have the financial interests that created the Federal Reserve System, and according to newspaper analysts at the time, published in those days, these men represented, or their firms that they represented, represented actually one-fourth of the wealth of the entire world. Now, if that isn't the money trust, I don't know what you would call it. An incredible concentration of economic power in the hands of just a few firms.
The money-centered banks were concerned about a development where, by you citing your book, that by 1896, 54% of deposits had moved to non-national, non-money-centered banks. How did that affect their reasons for meeting?
Well, yes, that's a very important fact of history that at the turn of the century, the West was expanding rapidly. Commerce was moving to the South. And so there are big cities growing up to the West and to the South. Banks were springing up there, which were not branches of the New York banks. And more and more of the nation's deposits were being moved into those Western and Southern banks. And as you mentioned, it was almost half by that time. They could project that into the future and say, we have to stop this. We do not want to lose control of the economic system of this country. And so that is the reason they formed a cartel. I mentioned before that the Federal Reserve System is a cartel. It's no different than a banana cartel or an oil cartel or a sugar cartel. This one just happens to be a banking cartel.
One of the specific problems they were trying to address was the phenomenon you discuss of currency drains and bank failures. How did they occur, and how do banking reserves relate to that phenomena?
Well, that is a condition that always arises when you have what I call dishonest banking. And I frankly say that's what our banking system is. And by that I mean that the banks are allowed to do things in their contracts with their customers that other businesses would never get away with. In other words, they're allowed to lie, basically, because they have everything they do is enshrined in law. But the law allows them to do that. And by that I mean that they tell depositors generally that they have demand deposits. You put your money into a checking account. Let's say you put $5,000 into a checking account, and they say, okay, here's your checkbook. You can demand it back anytime you want. Just write a check, and we will give it back to you. Well, immediately they turn that around, and they either loan it to somebody else, or they use it as a reserve, and they create money out of nothing and loan nine times that amount to somebody else. So that as long as only a few people come back and demand their money through that process, everything's fine. They've got it in the vault. But if more than 3 or 4 or 5% of the people decide they want their money, the banks have to admit, oops, well, we didn't tell you the truth. We didn't keep it in the vault. We cannot give it back to you because we just don't have it. And that's where they have these runs on the bank and the bank holidays and all that sort of thing.
As I understand it, these men were looking to have exclusive control over a large reserve pool.
That's it, exactly. So what do you do about that? You either go honest and play the game and tell the depositors that, no, under certain circumstances, you can't have the money back because of these reasons, or you just pool your resources with other banks and say, well, we'll help each other out. So if there's a run on your bank, we'll help you, and if there's a run on my bank, you help me, and we'll just tide it over, and everything will be fine. And that's basically what they were trying to do with the Federal Reserve System, is to get all the banks to help each other in a giant pool. It did help in small regional runs on the bank, but it just meant that the problem got bigger, so that now instead of regional problems, we have a national problem.
And in addition, as you pointed out earlier in your remarks, it results in the phenomenon of inflation, which is sort of a way of making the average consumer pay for the bank's losses.
Well, that's it, exactly. When the banks loan out more money than they have on deposit, that expands the money supply. And that's the phenomenon that causes inflation and that steals the purchasing power of our dollars, you bet.
What is fiat money, this business of creating something, money out of nothing?
Money comes into being by decree. Someone with the authority says, this shall now be money, and you shall accept it or go to prison. And that's the way most money systems are, because they don't have intrinsic value. If money was backed by gold or silver, there wouldn't have to be any decree forcing you to accept it. Everybody would take a gold coin or silver coin, and there's very few people that wouldn't do that. But when somebody offers you a piece of paper, says this is worth 20 units of something or other, you might say, well, who else will take that piece of paper? Fiat money simply means that someone, usually the government historically, decrees that money comes into existence. In the United States, since the formation of the Federal Reserve System, the government does not do that, but the Federal Reserve, in other words, the private banks do that.
So these guys got an exclusive franchise on money creation?
That's it, exactly. The private banks, through the Federal Reserve Act, were given an exclusive franchise or a monopoly over the nation's money supply. It's an incredible feat, and they did it mainly because the American people didn't understand what was happening.
So this, in addition, then, would give them a tremendous control over general national economic activity.
Well, that's what I said in the beginning, and not only national economic activity, but personal economic activity, and also control over the government. Shift of power, a balance of power. It used to be that you'd say, well, the government controls the banks. And now, if you have to be really honest about it, you think, wait a minute, I think it's the banks that are controlling the government.
Well, now, they had to try to sell this to Congress. And at the time, there was a lot of feeling against a European-style central bank. And you point out one of the tactics they used in selling it was in the name itself, Federal Reserve System. Could you talk about that?
Yes, brilliant. See, these people are not stupid. They're master psychologists and politicians as well as businessmen. And they knew that Congress had already dug its heels in against the name Central Bank. Well, now, for the benefit of the listeners here that don't know what that means, it doesn't really mean very much unless you give it a meaning. If you look it up in the encyclopedia or in an economics textbook, central bank is that phrase or those words they give to the very thing we're talking about, the Federal Reserve System, which is a group of private banks that have been given the power to create and extinguish the nation's money supply. That's what a central bank is, and that's what they called it in Europe at the time the Federal Reserve System was being debated. And American politicians said, no, we don't want a central bank at all. That's what they do in Europe. We're Americans. We want something different, unique. You know, this is America. And so the guys on Jekyll Island said, okay, guys, we can't call this a central bank. Everybody got that? So what are we going to call it? What are we going to call this central bank so that nobody will know? And they came up with the word federal. That was because it made it sound like it has something to do with the federal government. And they put the word reserve in there. That made it sound like there were reserves, and there aren't any. I mean, to speak of, very minuscule. And they added the word system. That was more important than it seems today. Because at the time, remember, the American people were concerned about the concentration of this power into New York and into the hands of a small group. And so they had to go through the appearance of distributing this power nationally over the regions of the United States. So they created all these regional banks, mostly as eyewash, just to make it look like a system rather than a concentrated monopolistic power. Finally, they added the word bank to it, and it's not a bank. So in all those words, you see, it's total deception.
They also launched a large PR campaign using something called the National Citizens League, which was directed by Mr. Warburg.
Yes. Yeah, they spent a little bit of money, a surprisingly small amount of money, actually, and they found people who were generally on the payroll of either the banks or some of the corporations where the banks sat on their boards of directors and controlled them. And they found compliant people, and they gave them a little bit of money, and they formed what they called citizen groups or educational study groups all around the country. They published pamphlets, and they tried to make it look like this was a grassroots movement. And indeed, a lot of people bought into it. They gave some money to a few of the large universities, and said, look, we're going to make a donation to your university, and you can open up a nice department of economics, provided that you appoint the man we suggest as the head of that department. And the university was happy to accept the money and make that appointment. And then this guy, whoever he was, this professor, would write a pamphlet about the glories of the Federal Reserve System. So it looked like it had the backing of academia. They did a lot of things like that. Even some of these people that were at Jekyll Island started to go around giving speeches and interviews to newspaper reporters condemning the Federal Reserve System. They'd say, oh, this is going to be bad for America. This is bad for business. And they knew that the average person would read that in the newspaper and say, oh, hey, Maud, listen to this. These bankers don't like the Federal Reserve Act very much. Must be pretty good.
Well, now, the act was passed early in Woodrow Wilson's first term, and you say that Woodrow Wilson was a political captive of Wall Street bankers. Could you talk about Wilson's relationship to Wall Street?
Well, Wilson was totally financed by Wall Street. He was he was handpicked by a very interesting character by the name of Edward Mandel House. He was the epitome of the insider. He was a collectivist. He had ties in London, and his goal was to collectivize and centralize the United States. He was a very close associate of Woodrow Wilson. House had very powerful political connections, and it was House who personally handpicked Woodrow Wilson. Just out of the sky, you might say, here's some nice little college professor and president, and got him the nomination for the Democratic Party. Wilson was always beholden to Edward Mandel House.
You mentioned that Wilson also had received, was the beneficiary of a private fund set up by Cleveland Dodge and Cyrus McCormick of National City Bank, the Rockefeller Bank, while he was at Princeton. They supplemented his salary.
Yes, that's a typical procedure to win over people like that, to get them financially dependent and grateful on the philanthropy, so-called, of the banks and the bankers. Woodrow Wilson was really always, from the very day one, always in the camp of the bankers. But now he knew that the people of America wanted to break the grip of the money trust, the very money trust that picked him, that got him the nomination for president, that supported him and financed him. He knew that the American people didn't like them, and so what did he do? He campaigned against the money trust, knowing that those were just words, and that the people would always, as they always have and still have, they always listen to a politician's words and never watch his deeds.
So in 1913, the Federal Reserve Act is passed. Did it stop the cycle of panics and slumps?
The Federal Reserve actually did not stop the cycle of panics or slumps. It exacerbated it. As I mentioned a moment ago, it took a problem which was mainly a regional problem, a local problem. The problem of failing banks usually never spilled beyond the borders of a single state, and not even that far quite often. It was at the city level. They got all the banks together by law, had to be in lockstep with each other. Now it was a national problem. And remember, the Federal Reserve System was formed in 1913, and it was just a few years later that we had the Great Panic and the Great Depression, which is clear from the record, as I see it, was caused by artificial manipulation of the money supply by the Federal Reserve System. So the Federal Reserve System did just the opposite of what it said it was going to do. It made matters worse.
We're coming to the end, unfortunately, of this fascinating subject, but I wonder if I could leave the listeners with your comments on a quote that's attributed to Meyer Rothschild, the founder of the Rothschild banking dynasty. It's mentioned in your book. It says, "Let me issue and control a nation's money, and I care not who writes the laws."
I have never been able to authenticate that quote from an original source, but I have no doubt that Rothschild believed it and probably said it many, many times. And if he didn't, it's certainly an obvious truth. When a man or a group of men can control the nation's money supply, they do control the nation. And that's the whole point of my comments here today. They control the nation at the individual level because they're controlling every person's pocketbook, and they control the nation at the political level because with that kind of economic power, they can buy and sell politicians at will.
Thanks very much for being with us today, Mr. Griffin. You're listening to History Counts, and we've been talking about the origins and operations of the Federal Reserve with G. Edward Griffin, author of The Creature from Jekyll Island, A Second Look at the Federal Reserve. Mr. Griffin's website is freedomforceinternational.org. This is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'll be right back. Should the United States have a central bank? Who should control money creation? These were hotly contested public issues during the first century and a half of the Republic. Over the opposition of Thomas Jefferson, Alexander Hamilton created the Bank of the United States, the Republic's first central bank, in 1791. Like the current institution, it was a private entity. It had the financial backing of rich individuals, including foreign investors. Unpopular with both local banks and the populace, it was killed by Congress in 1811. Its successor, the Second Bank of the United States, suffered a similar fate in 1836 at the hands of President Andrew Jackson. In proclaiming the central bank's imminent demise, President Jackson said, "I have it chained. I am ready with the screw to draw every tooth and then the stumps." Thank you for joining us. History Counts is broadcast on the first Thursday of the month at 12:30 in the afternoon and on the first Sunday of the month at 10 o'clock at night. It's produced by MDR Productions, Inc. and engineered by David Schwartz. Please visit us at historycounts.org, where you can listen for free to an archive of our programs. Until next time, this is Ken McDermott Rowe for History Counts.